trying to infiltrate and control these groups, which may rise up in the next couple of years.
Okay. And on that note, I appreciate both of you being with me on the spotlight. We're out of time. Steve Kinn, economist and author out of Amsterdam. Tony Gosling, investigative journalist out of Bristol. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi, signing off for myself and other crew right here in Tehran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqarah, recited by Ali Parhiskar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Mathalu alladhina yunfiquna amwalahum fi sabilillahi kamathali hab بَتِنْ أَنْبَتَتْ سَبْعَ سَنَابِلٍ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنْبَتَتْ سَبْعَ سَنَابِلَ فِي كُلِّ سُنْبُلَةٍ مِئَةُ حَبَّةٍ والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون زنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of the grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every ear. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
That lines. People in Iran lay to rest the victims of a terror attack that hit the southern city of Shiraz over the weekend. The Palestinian Prime Minister slams the culture of impunity among Israeli forces, saying they killed Palestinians with no regard for international law. Pyongyang says an American soldier who was defected to North Korea intended to escape racial discrimination in the U.S. Army. Top story for this half hour. Iranians in the southern city of Shiraz are holding funeral processions for the victims of a terror attack on a holy shrine over the weekend. Mourners have filled the streets in Shiraz to lay to rest 2 people killed in Sunday's attack. Several more were wounded after a gunman opened fire at an entrance of the Shah Chiragh shrine. The assailant was arrested on the scene. Security forces also detained 10 foreign suspects over the shooting. The United Nations and the European Union have condemned the terrorist attack. A number of countries, including Syria and Russia, have issued condemnations as well. In October last year, the same holy shrine was targeted by terrorists that left over 12 people dead. Moving on, Iran's foreign minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian has slammed the European Union's sanctions policy toward the Islamic Republic, describing it as unconstructive and ineffective. In a phone call with EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell, the top Iranian diplomat called sanctions an unfriendly measure in Brussels' relations with Tehran. Amir Abdollahian said the continuation of this situation does not benefit Europe. He added that Iran and the International Atomic Energy Agency are on the right path of cooperation. Amir Abdollahian also touched upon Iran's policy regarding the Ukraine war. He once again rejected claims by Kiev and its Western allies that Iran is providing Russia with drones to be used in its war with Ukraine. Borrell, for his part, said some misunderstandings between Iran and Europe can be resolved through dialogue. The International Military Technical Forum, Army 2023, is taking place in Moscow region until the 20th of August. This year's Army Expo is the 9th edition of the show, which showcases new products in the military industry and includes equipment demonstrations from over 70 countries.
Around 800 delegates from 76 countries have arrived at the International Military Technical Forum held in Moscow region. Their presence showed a desire to strengthen and develop mutually beneficial cooperation with Russia, despite the West's anti-Russian sanctions. Addressing the participants, President Vladimir Putin noted that the U.S., along with NATO members, use all military and non-military means to pressure nations into submitting to their will, adding that all this is taking place amid a disintegrating arms control framework.
In particular, the United States intent on reformatting the existing system of interstate relations in the Asia-Pacific region as it deems fit. In fact, efforts to promote these so-called Indo-Pacific strategies are aimed at creating U.S.-led military and political associations. We cannot exclude that these efforts may pave the way to fully integrate NATO forces with the AUKUS structures as they take shape.
Putin stated Ukraine as a case which demonstrates where the Western policy of pouring fuel on fire leads.
By pumping billions of dollars into the neo-Nazi regime and supplying it with equipment, arms and munitions, sending military advisors and mercenaries there, they are doing everything to further escalate the conflict and draw other countries into it.
According to the Russian defense minister, Ukraine's military resource is almost exhausted, and a special military operation has shown that there is nothing invulnerable to Russian weapons on the battlefield today.
No one should have any illusions that against the backdrop of a special military operation, Russian interests can be harmed. I wanted to draw attention to the fact that we also have cluster munitions in service. Until now, for humanitarian reasons, we have refrained from using them. However, this decision may be reconsidered.
This year, the forum is widely represented by weapons and military equipment that have already proven efficient in action. According to the Russian defense minister, the Russian army is expected to sign contracts worth over $4.7 billion at the forum. Iran has also presented a whole range of new combat drones.
Russia has expressed its determination to deepen technological partnerships and military technical cooperation with other countries and also continue taking advantage of the already established cooperation ties. The Army Expo's success is a clear indication that the West has lost most of its power in forcing countries to bend to its will. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
Well, as we mentioned on the top of the hour, Iranians and the southern city of Shiraz are holding funeral processions for the victims of a terror attack on a holy shrine over the weekend. Mehdi Abbasian is joining us now from the city of Shiraz to tell us more about today's processions.
Well, right now I'm in the holy shrine of Hazrat Shah Chiragh in the city of Shiraz. Today was a day of public mourning in this city and in the city Shiraz due to the loss of two of our countrymen in a terror attack that rocked the city on Sunday. A terrorist who attempted to enter the holy shrine and open fire on pilgrims who were inside the shrine. But fortunately, he was prevented from entering the crowded part of the shrine where pilgrims were performing their evening prayers. And believe me, a tragedy was prevented. Now, today, as I said, a day of public mourning, the people in this city took to the streets. There was a long procession. People took part in the funeral procession of the victims of this attack, two men. One of them was killed instantly on the day of the attack. However, the other one passed away the day after in the hospital after he succumbed to his wounds. The bodies of the martyrs will be brought for performance of the rituals, and then they will be buried here in the courtyard of the holy shrine of Hazrat Shah Chiragh, next to the victims of the last year, last October, terror attack here in Shah Chiragh, Occident. About the latest updates that we have is that the victims, two were killed, six people were injured, some of them critically injured in the previous days. However, three of them have been released from the hospital, but the remaining three, two of them are in the ICU, doctors say they have undergone successful surgeries, and there is no need to worry about, and they will be fine soon. And regarding the number of people arrested due to their association with the terrorist or those behind this heinous crime, there are reports from the security officials that an 11th person has been arrested as well. Back to you.
All right, thanks a lot, Mehdi Abbasian, joining us from the southern city of Shiraz. The Palestinian prime minister has come down hard on Israel after the regime forces killed two young Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. Mohammed Shataya said the Israeli terror machine does not stop committing crimes against Palestinians due to impunity enjoyed by perpetrators of such atrocities. He added that Israel continues to kill Palestinians without the slightest regard for international law. On Tuesday, two Palestinians were shot dead during an Israeli raid on a refugee camp near the occupied West Bank city of Ariha. This year alone, more than 200 Palestinians have been killed in the occupied territories. North Korea says an American soldier who crossed into its territory in July did so because of inhuman maltreatment and racial discrimination within the U.S. Army. North Korea's state news agency said Travis King crossed into the North deliberately and illegally in order to stay there or seek refuge in a third country. Pyongyang said King is disillusioned at the unequal American society. It added that the U.S. soldier is currently under control of the North Korean soldier as the investigation continues. King dashed into the North while on a civilian tour of the heavily fortified border between the two Koreas. U.S. officials say he was due to face disciplinary measures at home as he was facing allegations of assault in South Korea. Donald Trump has been indicted for the fourth time this year, and he now faces a five-year prison term in the state of Georgia if convicted. Even if Trump wins re-election in 2024, he cannot pardon himself in this case, meaning the political drama in the United States has reached a new fever pitch. Rami Mazari has more on the story from Chicago.
For the fourth time in 5 months, ex-President Donald Trump has been indicted and will be forced to stand trial, this time over alleged 2020 election interference in the state of Georgia. Ex-New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani joins Trump and nearly 20 others who will be collectively tried for violating a law normally associated with gangsters.
The indictment alleges that rather than abide by Georgia's legal process for election challenges, the defendants engaged in a criminal racketeering enterprise to overturn Georgia's presidential election result.
A conviction of racketeering in Georgia has a minimum prison sentence of 5 years. Polls have Trump as a certain lock to win the Republican presidential nomination, and he's neck and neck with incumbent President Joe Biden for next year's election. Trump has gained 8 points among Republicans and Republican-leaning independents since the first indictment was handed down, as the spate of court cases has many accusing the ruling party of persecuting political opponents.
I definitely think it's a witch hunt because, I mean, it's like, Wolf, how many times are they going to say he's indicted? And I just think, I do believe that it's also election interference. I believe that they really don't want him to run the establishment. I believe that they want to keep Biden in office.
A recent poll found that 12% of America says that the use of force is justified to keep Trump from winning the presidency, while 7% of Trump supporters say force is justified to restore Trump to the presidency.
I absolutely support it. And, I was just talking to my son yesterday when the fourth came through, and I'm like, you know, it's just hard for me to imagine that you could have someone, the leader of one of the world's best countries or used to be in the world, and he could try to overthrow a legitimate campaign vote. So, no, I'm all for the indictments.
The Georgia trial is the only of Trump's four indictments, which is likely to be televised. The indictments have often seemed timed to coincide to overshadow developments in the corruption allegations of Joe Biden's son, Hunter Biden.
You know, we've been saying for a while that Trump is a criminal, and the issue is that we have a criminal system. So, Trump being indicted, we hope that he goes to jail. We hope that he goes to prison. I don't think that it's going to happen personally. But at the same time, you know, some of the people who are pushing these charges, you know, are also a part of this criminal system. and also, you know, need to be held accountable for the things that they've done.
Trump's goal may be to delay the trials past the November 2024 vote, although he cannot pardon himself in the Georgia case, while Democrats are accused of slow-walking the investigations to tarnish Trump throughout the upcoming election campaign.
What the continued lawsuits make certain is that there will be no national reconciliation over the still-disputed 2020 election, only further estrangement, and with no end in sight. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
The government of Canada's Northwest Territories has declared a state of emergency as the region grapples with out-of-control wildfires. Local officials say the declaration enables them to deploy necessary resources and protect residents. The wildfires have so far destroyed one remote community and threatened the territorial capital city of Yellowknife. Northwest Territories has seen 265 wildfires so far this year, much higher than its 10-year annual average of 185. Wildfires are raging on in all 13 Canadian provinces and territories, forcing home evacuations and disrupting energy production. Niger's military rulers say they are open to talks to find a solution for the regional crisis caused by last month's coup that toppled President Mohamed Bazoum. The announcement was made by Niger's junta-appointed prime minister following a meeting with the Chadian president. Ali Mohamed Lamine Zane said Niger is going through a transition process and wants to remain independent. His remarks came as West African army chiefs are set to discuss Niger's coup on Thursday and Friday. The meeting takes place after the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, threatened military intervention in Niger to reinstate the country's deposed president. On Tuesday, the Economic Community of Central African States said it supports ECOWAS's efforts to overturn the coup. In the UK, the unemployment rate has climbed in the 3 months to the end of June, adding to the miseries of people struggling with the worst cost of living crisis in a generation. Official data shows the number of people out of work in the period increased to 4.2%. compared to 4% in the previous quarter. Britain has been rocked by public and private sector walkouts for months. The employees demand pay increases proportionate to the country's inflation. The UK's inflation rate has risen for well over a year, peaking above 11% in October. The inflation now standing at around 8%, the highest among G7 nations. The Bank of England is tasked by the UK government with keeping the annual inflation at around 2%. Former member of British Parliament Lambert Opig joined us earlier and to weigh in on the factors driving the UK's deteriorating inflation.
There are actually four factors. The first one is Brexit. The United Kingdom left the European Union, which isn't actually performing very well either, but better than the UK. And the Brexit effect means that I know from personal experience, some businesses are simply leaving the United Kingdom and going into the EU, really to avoid tariffs and for other reasons. Secondly, we have a very stupid energy policy, which is related to the idea of cutting carbon dioxide emissions. But really, we've just exported those emissions to places like China. Then we buy the products back, but we haven't made them ourselves, so that's causing problems. Thirdly, the very high interest rate is having a really bad effect, and for reasons that we might go into if you want, the interest rate is really damaging our economy. And then finally, you mentioned it yourself, we have many strikes, and I think that the industrial unrest itself is beginning to cause instability. Those four factors mean that the government really isn't in control of this anymore. And you said it yourself, the target for the Bank of England is 2% inflation. We've got 8%. And for all those reasons, unemployment's going up.
That's a wrap for now.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran
via shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure, and provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
in the limelight.
Systematic abuse by Zionist settlers has displaced yet another Palestinian community. Dozens of families from the Qabun hamlets were forcibly transferred from their ancestral homes. They're not the first. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for the second part, please. Middle East Eye wrote, during 1970s, the seeds of Israeli regime settlement enterprise took root in the southern Al-Khalil region as it voraciously consumed vast stretches of Palestinian land. The expansion then extended its tendrils toward the pristine landscapes of Masafer Yatta, transforming these idyllic areas into Zionist settlements. In defiance of multiple verdicts issued by the Zionist regime courts mandating the eviction of these communities, the Palestinian residents say they will stand firm, unwavering in their commitment to remain. In response, the Zionist regime has unshackled its settlers and troops, unleashing a campaign of oppression to force their departure. A Palestinian man told Middle East Eye, settler incursions onto our lands and sporadic assaults have become grimly routine. Our livestock are pilfered and on one occasion brutally slain. They obstruct our movements and restrict our access, while the troops storm our dwellings under the guise of hunting smugglers and those lacking permits. Destruction of property and physical abuse marked by beatings and derogatory language have become our daily ordeal. The Israeli regime assault on Bedouin territories isn't a recent phenomenon, but a battle that has persisted over many years. Sohail Khalilie, director of the Settlement Monitoring Unit at the Applied Research Institute in Al-Quds, ARIJ, shed light on the plan for the expulsion of Bedouin populations in East Al-Quds, paving the way for the realization of the E1 project, part of the Greater Al-Quds Expansion Scheme. Khalilie told MEE, "For over two decades, Israel has articulated into intention to sterilize the region east of Al-Quds, the southern Al-Khalil Zone, and the vicinity of the Jordan Valley. Using a term frequently used by Israeli regime authorities in reference to the expulsion of Bedouins," he added, "this strategic maneuver is designed to displace the Bedouin communities, confining them to prescribed enclaves. The reality far surpasses what the media portrays. The ongoing battle against them is fierce, characterized by Israel's utilization of every conceivable tactic to forcibly expel them." As per the 2017 statistics unveiled by the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Human Rights Affairs in the Occupied Palestinian Territories, OCHA, a stark reality emerges regarding the potential forced displacement of 46 Bedouin communities in the central West Bank. Of these communities, 26 find themselves within the jurisdiction of Al-Quds Governorate. A total of 4,856 Bedouin. These people grappled with dire living conditions, marked by severe deficits in fundamental services like water and electricity. Their challenges are further compounded by limited access to essential educational and healthcare facilities. The data furnished by the UN underscores that over 70% of the residents within these communities are refugees who were expelled by the Zionist regime in 1948 from their original homes in southern occupied Palestine. A staggering 90% of them rely on livestock grazing as their primary source of livelihood. Most of their homes have been marked for demolition, with a staggering 85% lacking access to both water and electricity. Khalili pointed out that Israel's approach includes an array of distressing tactics, including the demolition of homes and schools, the senseless killing of livestock, the relentless harassment of shepherds and farmers, the deliberate burning of crops, violent physical assaults that can be deadly, the sabotage of wells, and obstructing the building of crucial infrastructure. These calculated methods, the ARIJ claims, unequivocally amount to the crime of ethnic cleansing. Khalile said, the Palestinian Bedouin communities stand as an impediment to the expansion of settlements. Consequently, they endure these brutal assaults with impunity. The systematic abuse faced by Bedouins in the West Bank mirrors the atrocities committed against the Bedouins in the Naqab and Bir al-Sabah in occupied Palestine during 1948. According to Wafa News Agency, in July, the Israeli regime occupation authorities and forces demolished, confiscated, or forced people to demolish 54 structures in East Al-Quds and Area C of the West Bank, including 20 homes, citing the lack of Israeli-issued building permits, which are almost impossible to obtain, and killed 10 Palestinians, according to the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, OCHA, in the occupied Palestinian territory. As a result of the demolitions, 66 Palestinians, including 34 children, were displaced, and the livelihoods of more than 795 others were affected, it said in its Protection of Civilians report covering the period between July 5th and 24th. 16 of the affected structures were provided by donors in response to previous demolitions. 15 out of those 16 structures were demolished in a single incident in Al-Montar, in the Al-Quds Governorate, and another structure was demolished in Beit Jala, near Beit Lahm. According to the report, 80% of the affected structures were in Area C. The remaining 11 structures were demolished in East Al-Quds, including 9 residential structures, resulting in the displacement of 5 households comprising 24 people, including 12 children. 8 out of the 11 structures demolished in East Al-Quds were destroyed by their owners to avoid the payment of fines to the Zionist regime authorities. Wafa News Agency added Israeli regime authorities demolished 2 agricultural-related structures in Area C of Birin near Bani Naim in Al-Khalil Governorate, allegedly for trespassing estate land. On July 11th, the Zionist regime forces forcibly evicted the elderly Qaith Sob Laban Palestinian couple from their home in the old city of Al-Quds, after their protected tenancy was terminated by Israeli regime courts. Following their eviction, their home was immediately handed over to the Zionist settlers. The United Nations Office for the High Commissioner for Human Rights in the occupied Palestinian territories stated that the Zionist laws used to evict the family are inherently discriminatory and in violation of the Zionist regime's human rights obligations. According to OCHA assessments, approximately 1,000 Palestinians are at risk of forced eviction in East Al-Quds, mainly due to court cases initiated by settler groups. In addition, 8 households were displaced from Al-Quds Governorate and the South Al-Khalil Hills, citing settler violence and loss of access to grazing land, said the OCHA report. On July 10th and 19th, 2023, seven households comprising 36 people, including 20 children and 8 women, all registered refugees of Al-Baqa Bedouin community in Al-Quds Governorate, and one Palestinian household comprising 13 people, including 9 children of the Vedadi herding community in South Al-Khalil Hills, dismantled their residential and livelihood structures and left their communities and relocated to safer places. According to the families, they left after increased settlement activities following the establishment of new shepherding and farming settlement outposts. About 300 people were displaced from Ras Al-Tin, Wadi Asir, Ain Samia, Lifjim, and Al-Baqa between 2022 and 2023, citing settler violence and loss of access to grazing land as the primary reasons.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Black and white.
En los tiempos modernos, en la época contemporánea.
In the modern era, in contemporary times, there is a constant phenomenon that occurs in countries and nations. It is a form of political involvement and power. In this way, we recognize it with a name, with an ideology, with a practice that is fascism. When we talk about fascism, sometimes some people, interested or out of ignorance, only pay attention to a certain period of its existence. At the time between the war and the Mussolini period, and 10 years later, Mussolini and Hitler. In the form that was expressed there, the defense of financial capital and the anti-communist struggle. But fascism means more than that. Fascism is represented in Salazar in Portugal, Franco in Spain, Suharto in Indonesia, Pinochet in Chile, and Videla in Argentina. In the end, there are many of them. They are dead. Yes, in the case of Chile, we're talking about 3,227 people murdered by the regime, without counting the disappeared detainees. If we add to that, there are 22,000 murdered by the regime in defense of big capital in Argentina. 22,000. And in old Spain, in Franco's Spain, 150,000 people were assassinated. In Suharto's period in Indonesia, there are practically close to a million murdered innocents. In the first days of the coup against the patriot Sukarno, there were more than 500,000 assassinated people, mainly union leaders, workers, communists, democratic people, people of the left who wanted sovereignty and did not want to be a colony of U.S. imperialism. Fascism is then the political and power expression of capital when it enters in a time of crisis. It enters a moment in which it cannot continue with the same democratic way of holding power. Fascism itself is not a single movement and not a single model. In fact, in the Chilean dictatorship, there were people who thought it was not a fascist regime because they did not see the development of a large Mussolini-style corporate state and they did not see privatization. Today, throughout the world, it is implemented in an institutional form. Pay attention. Let's not forget that Hitler came to power and government through elections. It happens that those who support the neoliberal model at all costs, who want to privatize everything and at the same time use an iron fist against the labor unions, against the strikes, against the student mobilizations, they say they are not fascists. They are fascists. They have the same fundamental interest in defending the oligarchy. We already know what their methods cause. They also have a very strong racist and chauvinistic ideological component in the world. There are the Zionists, for example, and their anti-Arab and anti-Palestinian measures. We clearly witness this anti-Chinese, anti-Russian, anti-Islamic policy at the international level that also replaced at some point what was the anti-Jewish policy. Today, many of Jews and Zionists are really fascists. Fascism has multiple ways of expressing itself. But what unites it, what puts it at the center of everything, is the defense of financial capital. Fascism is represented in Bolsonaro in Brazil and Trump in the United States. Be careful. The Democrats with Biden are still practicing fascism by supporting reactionary governments and the servants of big capital. I'm Eduardo Artes. This is Black and White. Today in our program, Black and White, I talk with Alvaro Ramos. He is a rector at Academy of Christian Humanism University. Welcome to our program, Alvaro.
Thank you very much, Eduardo.
After the end of the Second World War, some thought that fascism and its expressions had no place in modern society. However, today we see that different expressions of fascism survive, and its historical definition manifests itself once again. It is the policy that comes to defend the financial capital and often expresses the power of financial capital. There is not a single way of expressing fascism. We didn't even witness that in the Second World War. There were different people in that time, like Benito Mussolini, Hitler, Hirohito, Francisco Franco, and Salazar, who acted differently. How do you see these fascist expressions today, which, by the way, are present not only in old Europe, but also in Latin America?
There's an interesting debate that can be a bit abstract, but is meaningful. Nowadays, people talk about different terms like radical right, the far right, neo-fascism, neo-Nazism, and etc. I believe that this whole set of categories are adequate in political essence and determine the type of actor that is on a stage. They all have something in common. As you said, there's a point that unites those figures, which is to defend the interests of big financial capital in particular circumstances. Normally, in a sense of stability and economic growth, when neoliberalism is expanding, these expressions are marginal. because hegemony and the construction of consensus regarding growth are produced quite by a spontaneous order. On the other hand, when the system enters into crisis and world economic growth, and particularly of certain countries, shrink, violent actors enter the scene, and precisely processes of failed revolutions take place, which leaves the condition for an onslaught based on the frustration of the countries. The frustration of countries generates the extreme right that halts the desires for changes. We need to look into a certain issue that is related to social psychology, media management, and economic contraction that needs a brutal force to push and finally puts the most violent actors of the economic system in the position of defense of their interests.
En una lógica de defensa brutal de sus intereses.
Correcto. O sea, tenemos la crisis.
We witness the anxiety of people in the face of financial crisis and its consequences. Then we immediately have this response. There is a factor that rises from self-proclaimed forces in labor unions in countries. I'm talking about the social democracy, particularly at least in the last century. Today, we could say that new tendencies, new lefts and postmodern ideologies do not provide a solution, nor are they able to help people with their unhappiness to overcome social difficulties. So we face this strong expression of fascism. How do social democracy and today's indefinite left pave the path for the extreme right that comes in the defense of the new liberal system?
Del sistema neoliberal.
Claro. Yo creo que tiene que ver.
That's right. I believe that today no political actor speaks to all of the people in the society. Why? Because a society has different rhythms and expectations. I think that the new left, in the logic of incorporating other perspectives, spoke of an urban world, but it also has a very important lack of the sphere of the popular world and especially of the rural world. There are different ways of understanding the problems and different expectations and different solutions in fragmented societies. In this framework, the authoritarian solution is very important because they say that they're going to solve this problem through an order imposed from world powers, which closes the debate. They have just installed a system of the police state that is going to solve the dynamics of the chaos. They believe that with this measure, they're going to bring people home again, so that those who need stability and order to live can benefit from this system. It means the reproduction of the world and life according to Max Weber. The logic behind this system is that one needs to leave his house every day, work, go back home, go shopping, manage his life and share everything with his family. It's a real need that the left cannot underestimate.
That is right. Workers need this same life too. They need security, work, and a decent life. Let's have a break, and then we will continue our program. Today I am with Alvaro Ramos. In the first part, we talked about the essentials that people require. The majority of people fight and work for a civilized world, a dignified life, a stable job, etc. But the democratic system doesn't provide them with those elements, because it is a form of administration of a system. But others offer a different form of administration of the same capital system. In this system, they make everything viable in the moment of crisis. It doesn't take place only in this era. Haji Muhammad Suharto killed thousands and thousands of people during the coup d'etat in Indonesia in the past. We're talking about 500,000 dead people. Then they established a very harsh fascist regime against Sukarno. They had a democratic attitude of administration. Can you mention some examples in today's world that express themselves as neo-fascists?
De este neofascismo.
Undoubtedly, I think we shall start with the U.S. I think that Donald Trump broke some traditions of the Republican Party. The Republican Party has always been a very right-wing party, but it cuts with some self-regulation that the same party had installed, like the idea that anything goes and denigration of any opponents. He broke the logic of the criteria of truth in political communication and attempted coups that he carried out just after leaving his mandate. This way of thinking has been replicated worldwide. It has formed an international style of governance known as Trumpism. For instance, there is Vox in Spain, Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil, Alternative for Germany in Germany, that is absorbing more fans. There are also representatives of this same trend in Italy and Greece and many other countries. What they have in common is precisely this modern form of installation on the political stage. Its forms are not like the old ultra-right. They don't actually use swastikas and they don't take up arms with anachronistic political marketing. They're absolutely modern, but their plans are very old. They apply the most brutal political bullying. They denigrate their opponents and ignore any kind of fair play in political disputes. I think there's also another reason for the formation of such movement, and that is the deprivation of contemporary societies, particularly in the West. The West is in a slow decline from the industrialization. Industrialization somehow created more technology, but also generated higher income jobs. This process is slowing down in Europe, the U.S., Canada, and Japan, where there is economic contraction, and we shall also mention the rise of Asia. Therefore, the change of actors in international geopolitics is reflected in the emergence of these groups that use pressure for their repossession. That's why the slogan of Trump is Make Trump Great Again. He wants to bring back the U.S. hegemony, which is in decline now. Trump believes that the U.S. is decaying not only as a global power, but in its economic structures, and therefore it needs to rebuild itself with a strong leader who is more protectionist, who focuses on a new form of industrialization and creates a new international hegemony based on unconquerable power.
Internacional basada en un poder incontestable.
Correct.
That's true. It is very important to consider what is really happening at the international level. For me, the Israeli Zionism is a concrete expression of neo-fascism. The people chosen by God, etc. It is actually my personal concern. The same thing happens in the U.S. with Obama, Biden, and even Trump. Last month, European Union Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell said that Europe is a garden that is surrounded by savages. He used this racist phrase in relation with other countries and continents in the world, which we used to call them the third world nations. What do you think about the ideas, ideologies, and expressions of such leaders?
They need to reaffirm their exceptionalism in international politics. American exceptionalism has always reaffirmed the idea that the order of the international system and international law does not apply to powers. This point is fundamental in their logic of action. They believe that all other countries must submit to the order of international system based on international conventions. This logic was established for centuries in order to have an international system that could provide and maintain international peace. But they consider themselves as exceptions that can ignore this order. That is why they cannot turn a blind eye to these regulations, and this is reflected in a crucial body that is the United Nations Security Council, where they have dominance and make this exceptionalism clear. So they have this privilege of being able to violate international law, invade other countries, generate a series of elements that simply make the international order based on a claim to international law unable to function due to its own lack of coherence.
The U.S. national security above all other issues, right? In the case of Latin America, they speak of lithium, copper, forests, the oxygen, water, and everything else. But they're actually talking about a part that forms the national security of the United States. This is exactly what Laura J. Richardson recently mentioned publicly. I want to know how countries shall deal with this new neo-fascist wave that has a concrete base that is determined by the general crisis of the system of domination and ultimately the unipolar system that has sparked chaos all over the world. There will be a new era. Nowadays, we witness the war in Ukraine, and it's not the same as other battles because Russia is in a war with NATO and the U.S. Ukraine is a minor player in this scenario. I think that this is just the beginning of a much bigger confrontation. However, there are fascist forces in Ukraine. There is not a single legal political party there right now. The forces follow Volodymyr Zelensky's orders. This is really frightening. There are also progressive governments that are U.S. allies or under the command of the U.S. and have to maintain excellent relations with them, for instance, the government of Chile.
I think that the case of Ukraine is a bloody war that is before our eyes and a contemporary drama. Maybe we can compare it with those massacres of the Second World War where thousands and thousands of men were thrown into trenches, almost like the First World War, who died in the mud due to interests of great powers. One of the few signs of hope I've seen in this year of war is how Lula has traveled the world to say two things. The first one that is very important is that this conflict leads to massacres, and the second thing is to find a solution. China proposed a peace plan. To me, any reasonable actor who could read this plan should agree with it, because it is in the immediate solution to a conflict that will not be over in the short term. This conflict requires gradual actions. The first solution is to end the death of so many people from both parties in the conflict, stop the blood path. Secondly, we need conditions to respect the international law. In the third part, reparations for war victims and form a framework of understanding in a new context without exceptionalism. North American exceptionalism is a problem in this context. All the actors of international order and powers must act according to the framework of international respect. There's an old saying that says, respect brings peace, and this is what's been violated today.
Y eso hoy día es lo que hoy día se ha vulnerado. Bueno, Álvaro, te agradezco mucho.
Thank you very much for coming to our program. However, the time was short. I hope to see you again. Thank you very much.
Muchas gracias.
Muchas gracias.
Hasta luego.
The limelight.
By the time COVID-19 hit, about 600,000 more people in the U.S. were dying each year compared to its peer nations. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Truthout noted, from 1930 through the middle of last century, the mortality rate in the United States of America was lower or consumerate with the mortality rates of other wealthy nations such as Canada, France, and Britain. However, in the late 1970s through 1980s, the U.S. health outcomes and mortality rates began to diverge from those of its peers. By 2021, about half of all U.S. deaths under the age of 65 would have been avoided if the U.S. mortality rates were on par with those of other countries, according to a new study published by the National Academy of Sciences. In other words, on average, one out of every two deaths under the age of 65 in the United States would be averted in countries like Australia, Germany, Japan, or Portugal. By the time COVID-19 hit, about 600,000 more people in the United States of America were dying each year than scientists would expect if mortality rates were equal to those of peer nations. COVID-19 then sent the number of excess deaths that exceed expected mortality rates skyrocketing. Study co-author Jacob Bohr, an assistant professor of global health and epidemiology at Boston University School of Public Health, said the media focused on drops in U.S. life expectancy during the COVID pandemic. But the study puts life expectancy data in the context of what that actually means and how poorly Americans are doing compared to other places. Life expectancy doesn't apply to an individual. It applies to a population, Bohr said in a statement.